Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Barum, and I'm joined by
Alexander Agunis, the Everyman Gamer.
And I'm James. I write Code Switch.
And today we are finally getting back to one of the most requested features on No Direction Beyond ever since we began it. That is Create Demi Planet!
Woo! They literally almost killed us when we had to cancel for Pathfinder 2 news.
Oh, gosh.
How dare we give good news?
How dare we?
I hated to do that cancel because we were really hyped for this episode, but it was one of our most viewed episodes all year, so worth it.
Yeah, you guys told us that, you know, you love us, but you really wanted to hear more about Second Edition, so we gave it to you.
But we're not here to talk about Second Edition for once. We're here to talk about Starfinder. We're here to talk about Species. If you all remember, we ended the last Create Demi Planet episode with a homework assignment. Each of us would take one of the three main populated planets of our new solar system and not only name that planet. I hope y'all named your planets. I see panic in James's eyes.
No, I didn't name the planet. I thought this was the species episode, not the planet naming episode.
So we were
James, it's okay. It's okay. Because every good sci-fi author knows that the species is always just named after the planet. So there you go. Or vice versa. It's why in Captain Marvel they call the people from Earth Terrans, because they call the planet Terra instead of Earth, and they've been doing that forever.
Or they call them Earthlings in, like, Mars Attacks.
I mean, that's true.
Wow.
We did it.
A lot to think about.
That's kind of like Halflings, but even lower to the ground.
I just see the Steve Harvey meme there. Just oh God. All right, I think I got something. I'm fine. All right. All right, we're good. Continue.
But not only that, we were to create their main species, in which we talked amongst each other, and more importantly, we discussed this at length on our Discord channel dedicated to the Create Demi Planet section. So, after this episode especially, that'll be hopping up again as we talk about what our next topic will be after this one. But now we have brought species to the table. And let's...
We have. But before we do, don't forget, we have a large tradition when it comes to Demi episodes. We have to go through all of our wonderful viewer contents. We have
three viewer contents. What are they?
Right. So for those of you who were not around when I used to do Private Sanctuary podcasts, we had Demi Plane as Create Demi Plane as one of our recurring things. And whenever we started a Create Demi Plane episode, we always started by going through the comments we got and talking a little bit about them on air, because it's a fun way to get our community involved in our community building project. So I went through the entire Create Demi Planet Discord, which you can access through our lovely Discord on nodirectionpodcast.com. We'll give a link towards the end. But here are the three questions. The first one is from user Lydis. He wants to suggest a topic that might fit in our series. He says that something has been bothering them. Most species, no matter how different their environments or where they evolved, have similar features. They have two eyes, usually two, but almost always even in number, have a sense of smell, have a mouth, are able to talk, have limbs, have a humanoid body shape, so on and so forth. Lydis asks, unless all these species are actually the result of being created by gods, aka intelligent design, and not due to evolution, how can he explain this incredibly implausible phenomenon to players? And I'm actually going to turn this question over to James, because James gave Lydis an excellent answer on our fantastic Discord channel. So James, please take it away.
We only have like one world to like go over stuff with, but there are a lot of biomes and we can look through fossil records to see a lot of changes. In general, things seem to fall into a couple symmetries, so that's why you have two sides, because left, right, so two eyes. Things that don't have that tend to have different arrangements, like scallops just have a crap ton of eyes in front. Starfish have them at the ends.
Starfish have eyes?
They have, like, light sensors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which are kind of like eyes.
I learned something on this podcast, guys.
Yeah, you're like, that's what your eyes do, but you have much more visual acuity.
I was thinking how, like, flounders, like, as they age, they move to the same side of their head because they lie on their side.
That is something that benefits where their niches, which is eating stuff out of the sand, and it allows them to keep an eye up on predators. So every place is going to have a selective pressure. It's just there's a lot of general things that are good. Things like smell, taste, those are chemoreception, where the sensing of chemicals just in different forms. And that's generally something that most life does. You need to get information some way. And it's not always as complicated as, like, for instance, your nose and your tongue are both chemoreceptors, but they find different things. So you're going to often have something like that to help you observe your surroundings. So, yeah, there's a lot of similarities. The bipedal, like, humanoid body plan is it just seems to be how it's worked out. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it's the bar none. We just have no other plan as to see anything else. Like, yeah. You see it's kind of repeated, you know, a dinosaur and a bird shape are kind of vaguely humanoid as well.
You see a lot of this in the Expanse novels that sort of explore this concept when they start exploring the small spoiler alert for the Expanse. When they start exploring the possibility of alien species, that there are just a few evolutionary good ideas that, say, predator species should have their eyes facing forward so that they can get stereoscopic vision. So more than one eye is good. Now, is there an upper limit to that? Maybe. I mean, on our own planet, we have insects with dozens and dozens of optic receptors.
You have chameleons that really only hunt with one eye if it's on one side of their face before lasering in.
And while you also have the idea that limbs are good, legs are a good way to manipulate yourself across an environment, wings are great for flying, just the basic solutions that interact with physics and gravity are going to form likely similarly across different evolutionary chains, even in radically different environments. While there will be radically different solutions based on those environments, things that interact with basic physics, such as the concept of light for vision or heat for vision or gravity and wind resistance and atmospheric pressure, things like that will likely have some similarities. Now, as for the prevalence of bipedal humanoids, we can thank sci-fi for that, because it's really hard and expensive to do anything else when you're dealing with 50s budgets for sci-fi shows. And Star Trek can only put so many eyebrows on a species.
No, Star Trek, make Balthians do it. Roll around all over the place.
I mean, it's a lot of it is familiarity, a lot of it is practicality, and then because of that practicality of the past, and we're basing our sci-fi on sci-fi of the past, is just evolving. There's a nostalgia trick. So it's a whole lot of tradition mixed with practicality, mixed with physics, mixed with evolution, as for why we see a lot of these common factors. So it isn't entirely implausible. But some of the implausibilities are because.
I think a good way that you can look at it is if you take the peoples indigenous to Europe and compare them to peoples indigenous to, like, North America, you're going to see differences in, like, structural building style, different tools, different customs and cultures. But, like, a lot of things between the two are comparable. They developed in similar ways because those tools and those structures have a benefit that you could just sort of, like, hey, oh, I'm trying to find the most efficient way to do the thing. You know, this pointy stick just happens to be the most efficient way for me to poke somebody with no metal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as time goes on, that's sort of how evolution works. It looks for environmental stressors, as James and I were talking about it earlier. Environmental stressors kind of make evolution try to figure out how to solve problems based on what's happening around them, and the most efficient solution wins, which might look the same in multiple places across multiple environments that are similar, even in different parts of a galaxy. And so we hope... Go ahead.
And if you look at some extremely isolated environments, such as small cave streams that have been completely isolated for millennia, you'll see that fish still developed there. Fish still had fins and looked moderately fish-shaped, even though they had absolutely no interaction with most biodiversity in the rest of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple things. Evolution doesn't solve anything. Evolution is just the consequence. There's actually a cave in Romania that's been cut off from outside intervention for like 3 million years, and there's a bunch of like crickets, centipedes, spiders, and some fish in there, and they just all kind of lost all pigmentation and eyes, but their body plans and things are generally the same, even though none of them can see down there. Mm-hmm. Everything is kind of, you know, what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. And you come to interesting conclusions in different ways. Like, I told this to Alex a while ago. There was an episode of PBS Aeons that went over flight, and that the flight was discovered four-ish different times. You have bats, you have insects, you have birds, and you have dinosaurs. Not dinosaurs, but pterosaurs, similar creatures. Insects are the only one to develop flight without modifying a limb structure.
Mm-hmm.
So radically different ways to get to the same solution, because man, flight is really overpowered.
Mm-hmm. That's really. Why you don't get it until level 5 if you play a Dragon King.
Screw you, gravity.
So on to the next question. Superfan James Vance asks, how many worlds are we starting with?
We don't four. Know. We're starting with at least 4.
Well, yeah. 4, yeah.
Yeah, we're starting with 4.
Right. The 3 how we're far developing. We... And the in the hell planet.
Yes. Yes. It's called Frodo or Frollo, like the dude in Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's canon. You can't stop me.
I thought it was a portmanteau of Frodo and YOLO.
It's both. There you go. It's the James is canon. We're doing it. Let's go.
God, I hate this.
You shouldn't have explained it. You shouldn't have explained what you thought. I might have actually given it up, but no, we're stuck with it now.
I'll just shoot me out of a cannon.
The realistic answer is that it's easier to focus on the set pieces and then expand outward from there. So if our major player species are coming from these 3 or 4 planets, then it makes sense to focus on them and then build outward. Sort of like how in Pathfinder started with fleshing out Galarian and then spread to the rest of the solar system. Starfinder does have the benefit of having distant worlds already be a thing, like James Sutter talked about in our last episode. So, sorry, we're not awesome like James Sutter. We don't have a book we can pull from, so we're going to have to make it up as we go.
That's okay. That's what they did at one point.
Exactly. I like that.
I think the final Pathfinder one started as James Jacobs' home campaign that was mostly just Veresia.
Yeah, I think Veresia started out like that. And I think different places were added by different people. But it definitely was like, hey, let's start with this. But yes, moving on to the final... this is less of a question and more of a topic. We do lots of awesome discussions on Create Demiplanet in our Discord channel. And one of the ones that we were talking about is how starships work in the system. Since we talked about if you fire a starship engine, specifically, I think we said the drift engines, right? If you fire that hyperspace engine, then it could fundamentally collapse space-time in the system and kill everybody.
Right.
So you don't want to... So that's very strictly outlawed. So people were like, oh, well, maybe you have, like, the UMA corpse ships that do everything. And we were talking about it, and we played it around, and our ultimate decision on it was no biological starships. James, do you want to take that further?
Yeah, for biological starships, there has to be a lot of weird confluence to make stuff happen. Like, if you put a whale on land, it falls apart. If you have an animal that's meant to live in space and you try to put it in an atmosphere, it's going to die. There's a creature that is simultaneously supposed to be an adult form in 2 places would have to just be a starship or be dead and not care about it. Mm. There's a lot of hoops to go jump over to make it believable. Mm-hmm. And you have examples like Tyranid hive ships in 40K. But those things are also grotesque monsters that nobody would want to ride in, except if you were part of a brood pool. So, like, I don't think anybody here is part of a brood pool of that caliber, so.
Yeah.
And also, you got to make it cooperate. Like, what, just put something on its back and just go, hi-ho, space whale.
Space whale adventure!
Yeah, and I love Farscape as much as the next sci-fi fan, but I'm kind of partial to our very dangerous starship concept where that suddenly our ships also become random encounter tables when we try to push the engines.
I also think that the fact that you can't bring a starship into this system is a feature of the setting that we wouldn't want to cheapen by allowing there to be a very obvious workaround, if that makes sense. Right. Like, if the point of the system is that you need teleporters to go from place to place, then it's like, well, why would you use the teleporters if you could just, you know, have these starships? And especially if they're still alive, then, like, like, where do these infinitely large creatures come from?
And also, if the bioships are interfacing with the drift, then the way they interface with the drift could very well be the exact same sorts of energy pollution that the normal starships cause. I mean, that would be bad.
It's even worth talking about, like, in the core Starfinder game, the Uma can't go into the drift. They're just space whales that fly around. Like, the ones that go into the ship, into the drift, and serve as starships are dead corpses of them that have basically been outfitted with starship technology. Mm-hmm. So, like, that would inherently have the same problem of accessing the drift could destroy the entire system. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I agree with Param and James that it's something that we would not really want to be a core feature.
And also, because of this, there would have to be like a mandatory distance you have to get away from the starship using sublight before you can drift in and out. And that means that you can be trapped in the system and having to do a mad chase for the jump border before you. And there is all sorts of fun things that can happen if you're having to. If suddenly getting out via drift is no longer a possibility, that some Horatio Hornblower stuff can go on.
One thing that I do think we should have is, like, if the teleport systems go throughout all the planets in the system, and that's how you kind of get from world to world in the system, there should be, like, some sort of, like, almost like a space elevator, but, like, a stellar elevator, like, on the outside of the system that, like, starships can dock and safely, like, get there with the drift engine without destroying everything. And, like, it's almost like a giant,
like space
parking
port.
Lot. Yeah, it's like a parking lot. for, like, that's, you know, the city in Norway that doesn't have cars and everything, bikes?
You mean Norway?
No, there's one specific city. Gosh, whatever. I'm done with you. Let's move on to... go ahead.
I don't know of it, but you can explain the concept.
Yeah, basically there's a city in Norway whose name's... like, it is illegal to drive a car into that city. If you have a car, you have to park it outside, and everybody basically gets around with buses, so, like, all the streets and sidewalks are adapted for bikers. Mm-hmm. And, like, the basic idea is, like, if you want to drive there to the city, you can, but you have to park your car outside, and then you have to use either walking or a bike to get around. So it's the same kind of idea. This is a system where you're not allowed to bring the starship in, so there's a place where you can park your starship and then teleport on the pads to wherever you need to go.
But we do have the teleports on a cycle.
Oh. Reynard Wolf in chat says the name of the city that I am trying to think of is Oslo. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I think it's time to dive into one of our species. Who wants to go first?
Yes. Do you want me to go first, or do one of you two want to go first?
Yours is too weird to lead us, Alex.
James! How about you go, Param? Oh, damn it.
James!
Oh, dang it. All right. So the world that I originally envisioned is a kind of, think like Cretaceous Earth, where it's a place that is, in general, pretty warm, humid the entire length of the year for most of it. You know, the poles in general are a little bit colder. And in there, I thought of a creature that kind of fits with how I think a creature that would find magic would work. There are some schools of thought about how intelligent life develops, and that there's added difficulty for aquatic creatures because the invention of fire is kind of like a non-starter. So magic might be something that you would use to get around that if you had the ability to. I mean, dolphin wizards are already scary enough of a thought. So I thought of something that was a little bit more amphibious, still tied to the water. We don't have any art for any of this stuff, but the idea behind it would be, at least physically, would be a creature that kind of looks like a sea lion, but with the carapace of a wombat, like how they're covered in cartilage to protect themselves. And the ability to go through the water to get away from predators. They're about 3 feet tall. They kind of have little mole noses for digging through sediment to go for prey. They have a lifespan that's different from mammals, in addition to not being warm-blooded, in that they just reproduce in giant swarm nets, kind of like 800 to 1,000 per birthing cycle per pairing. But the mortality rate is like ridiculously high. Like you expect maybe 5 or 10 to reach nymph stage and about 2 to 4 to reach adulthood. And that process takes a couple months. And it's at that point where those survivors come back into the society and are allowed to actually participate, because there's no use getting attached to that many if they're going to perish it regardless.
So what makes them all perish?
Oh, natural prey, natural hunters.
So how come they haven't developed technologies that would like let them have the babies in places where the babies aren't going to get eaten?
So when you have a certain amount of resources, you can't extend that resource. The places I think this is kind of evident from the setting with some of its issues is that it's not a post-scarcity society. At least this planet isn't. There's also kind of a traditional benefit to having this happen, because it does allow the most fit of that brood to come to age, and you don't spend too much investment resources in something that's not going to pay dividends. Their lifespan's around 25 to 35 years, and it takes about 2 years to get to full adulthood. So the amount of proportional knowledge and experience one can gain into the world is limited as well.
This strikes me as a very evil society.
Not inherently, just different in how it works. Mm-hmm. So as part of them initially starting aquatic, they have some aptitude towards magic. They have some abilities beyond that. Do we want to leave like actual like stats for later for the end, and we just want to go over like setting bits of it, or how do you guys want to do that?
Sure, we'll round robin it. So that is the generic pitch for that's the top order pitch for the species.
I probably could have said that better. By the way, I thought of a name. The name is Twi.
Twi? I like Twi.
T-H-U-I. Oh, also interesting, they have separated vocal and digestive tracts so they can eat and breathe at the same time, or breathe and talk.
I'm assuming this is because it's a skill that you very much wish you...
Well, also, if you're aquatic, you want to be able to, like, open your mouth to eat and not, like, worry about drowning. So if that's they're fair. Separated, yeah.
Alex!
They are amphibious, sorry, but, you know... water is very important to them. Alex, sorry, go ahead.
That's all right. So for my race, they are called the Echians, and they're from Echion is their planet. And when we originally decided how we were going to do this, we actually doled out who was closest to the sun, because whoever was closest was going to get the worst time of things, just because of the giant magical disruption fields coming out from that. Mysterious event would definitely affect planets that were closer than further away. That's what we came up right with, the destabilization field. All right, so Echion is the closest planet, and so my planet got screwed up the most, and I wanted to have a species that felt like they had lost something from that cataclysmic event. So what I came up with, the Echians, I got the name from doing a little bit of research on mythology, and the name is loosely based on Echion, who is one of the Greek, the ancient Greek giant characters. I think he's the one who shapes the winds, but that doesn't actually matter for that. It's just a little bit of fun factoids. So the idea is that the Echions, prior to this destabilization event, were like this big, burly race of a rowdy, like a very strong warrior hero culture, where you were supposed to go out and you were supposed to accomplish great things for the society. And the best way like to have your end is to like have your songs be told because you died gloriously in battle. It's like this really big, traditional, almost Viking slash Spartan style culture. But following the stellar destabilization, the blast of magic that came out and washed over the planet dramatically altered their DNA. So new members of the species born after this event, or who even hadn't reached the age of maturity during the event, they could not physically age past the age of 10. So they stayed like really short and scrawny and small. And you have this race of, like, intellectually they're the same as, you know, they, any of the species would have been, but they are essentially, like, almost stunted, and they can't reach that same level of physical strength that their ancient stories and their warrior traditions go to. But what they did find out is that being infused with magic in a way that literally makes you 10 years old forever because they can't age anymore. In addition to getting this kind of anti-aging property, it also makes it so that you get weird fancy powers. And so one of the things that they can do is they can actually encase their body in elemental aether, aether being the element that makes the boundaries between planes. And they basically build themselves these elemental suits of magic armor to try to make themselves look bigger and to make up for this disability that they now all have. Whether or not it works depends on who you talk to, but they have a lot of strong powers that give them psychokinetic abilities. So they go from these big burly giants to these like scrawny kids from like Earthbound with psychic power. Because Earthbound is a great game.
What type of powers do you talk about?
Okay, I didn't want to. So if I tell you about them, it's going to be literally me telling. If we're going to round robin them, I'm going to hold that off. But psychokinetic powers is the answer to your question.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess that's up. My species is the Evviru, Evviru, and they are a species of herbivoric herd animals that became the dominant species of their planet through pure stubbornness and organization.
Bureaucrats!
well, sort of, but this is more like the herd is all. Like, this is a species that is very much, the community is so much more important than the individual. And their government is...
Social bureaucrats!
Their government's called the Protectorate, and they are extremely authoritarian. The species, they resemble, they're basically tiny little, they're tiny little plump deer centaurs. So they're medium sized, but they have four legs and arms and antlers, and their society is, like I said, extremely isolationist and herd based. And one of the things that are most common is, as a herbivorous species, all conflict is completely taboo. So you go by the rules of the society. Do not make waves. Do not argue. Do not... Any sort of argument is like a horrible crime and sin. And the worst of all is any form of violence. Any form of violence is the ultimate crime on their planet. But you can't be a dominant species on the planet and completely avoid violence. Violence is going to be a necessity. It's going to happen. Things are going to want to eat you. You're going to have to defend your borders. War is going to happen. So to facilitate this need, what they do is they hold a lottery whenever there is a need for a warrior class to come into an existence. And they basically have this lottery and randomly recruit amongst their young adult members enough of their species in order to form up this fighting force, whether it's just one person to go hunt that terrible predator that keeps spitting it, or, you know, hundreds of thousands to go fight this war because the other planet is getting a little bit too pushy on their border. But what happens afterwards is all violence is the most terrible crime. This is not an excuse just because you got recruited to it. Any of their species that has been recruited, which I'm calling wild thorns, as what their term for them, when it is over and it's time for that species to return, they're like, nope, you either go to this reservation or this concentration camp where we will corral you, and that is where you will stay until you die off. You are not allowed to interact with our society because you will poison it with your terrible violence that you committed. Or get off the planet. You can leave, never return. And so basically any Evviru that you encounter off of the world is almost guaranteed to have been a wild thorn for one point or another.
I like the psychopaths S vibes of like negative energy and negative actions are something that are pollutative and additive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
this is cool.
It is an incredibly it's like very strict society, very like I was getting a lot of Star Trek vibes from various species that they feature that have similar effects. And I just wanted this to be very extreme. And basically, if you're an adventurer from this, you basically have your character origin just wrapped up right here for you. Just here's a present. Here's your background.
I had to punch the school bully and I got exiled.
Yeah, good.
So in chat, Reynard Wolf says, "Why were you exiled from your planet? I won a lottery to squish a spider." how does the culture view violence? Like are we is attacking a spider like that enough?
Yes, to get you kicked totally. Off the planet? Yeah. Squish a spider, dead, gone. Get
what if it's by accident? As in, like,
no, there's no such thing as accidents. This is an absolute authoritarian government. You stepped on it by accident. You fell.
Does
you bumped into your friend and it broke his leg. That was violence. You're out of here.
So does that mean that, like, if someone like is walking down the street like with arms full of groceries, I'm obviously carrots and other leafy greens, right. And they go ahead and they step on a spider. And they find the guts when they get home. They have to spend the rest of their life trying to hide their heinous crime or get thrown off the planet.
It's very likely that they will rush immediately to the herd elder and turn themselves in. Because the gaslighting is absolutely extreme. Like, a society like this only works if everyone is bought into it.
Oh, gosh. So you're talking about a lot of psychic trauma from these people, too. Like,
oh, absolutely.
I stepped on a spider!
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. This is not meant to be a happy little society. It has peace at a great cost.
Lava being asked, will they defend themselves in person when interacting socially, or are they complete pushovers socially?
They are not pushovers. They basically go into full nope mode and go into full defense. Including socially, they are incredibly stubborn diplomatically, and they will just throw up barriers and not participate in arguments or conversations that they disagree with. So if either you're working with them for exactly what they want, or they nope the heck out of there.
Is it illegal for technomancers of their race to learn the explosion spell?
Any sort of violent option would be incredibly taboo and likely illegal on the planet.
So if they learned it, they'd get kicked off. Not even if they used it. Just like if someone figured out. What if you were like, what if you were somebody who like, Starfinder doesn't really have like just magic, but like if you're like a sorcerer type of character who got their powers from their own bloodline, and that bloodline manifested into like a burning hand spell, would you get kicked off because you were obviously
you would be a horrific. Bad amount. You like that is a terrible mutation that is inherently corrosive to society. Yeah, you would have to be removed. No questions. No leeway. This is not an area where this is not a society where any sort of gray corner case is even tolerated.
So, do they hold members of other species to this standard when they're coming to visit, or do they like just not let off workers on the?
Well, if you're on their planet, which they're incredibly isolationist, then you're expected to be on these rules or you will be kicked off forever.
So isolationist that they're never going to want to interact with anything James and I did?
Mostly except for the convergence, which is what I've called the horrible event, has meant that they've had to drop their Japan-like pure isolationism because what it did to the planet was drastically alter the birth rates. So now the predatory species that they have had under control and careful, you know, production is now overbreeding and getting bigger and meaner. And so the need for violence is more and more and more and more. So now they are basically having to reach out to the other planets going, "Help, we don't want to be tiger food." And so that has become a humongous strain on their society. There are more and more wild thorns being produced due to more and more lotteries having to happen. They do have non-lethal weapons, and like that's their big planetary specialty as far as war is concerned, because any form of bloodshed is considered violence, but subduing is like a corner case. So they have like, you know, stun guns and basically very, very soft touch.
You're not bleeding. It's fine. You're not bleeding. It's fine.
Yeah, but if you get a headache, oh, wait, we've got, that might be a problem.
So biohackers are big there because they just stick you with needles. Needles are medicine. That's fine. That's not violence. That's medicine.
Yeah.
Oh, this would be a really fun race, if only because, like, playing a psychology that is forced to confront its own nature is really
fun. Also, what do you think about mercenaries? You think you'd probably hire mercenaries for some of those problems?
Wildthorns are basically mercenaries. these are very
interesting problems to explore in the setting now that this is starting to become a necessity. For, you know, for millennia, they've evolved to the point that they had all this stuff on control. And now, this freaking convergence throws all that out of whack. Suddenly people are like, well, maybe violence isn't too bad. No, heathen, get off the planet. But if they commit violence, is it still violence? Like, these questions are things to now answer in the setting.
So basically, society is on the verge of collapsing for them, at least the social order. Right.
But of course, the Protectorate is doing so by doubling down and clamping down like all authoritarian regimes
do. That is a fun setting for that planet. That is really cool. But now that everybody's talked a little bit about their species, we should talk about what players get for playing them. James, would you like to go first?
Sure, I'll go first. I made a small creature, and I was told that small creatures generally get 2 hit points per level. So, 2 hit points per level. You're also small. You end up with a -2 to your dexterity because of your giant shell made of cartilage. You also get +2 to your intelligence and a +2 to your constitution score. Being able to jump between land and water kind of makes you pretty hardy, as well as living in a jungle. They have the amphibious subtype, so they can breathe underwater. They have a 30-foot swim speed and a 25-foot land speed. They're a bit gangly with their on-land gait, and that's what accounts for that land speed difference. Mm-hmm. They get inherent +2 bonuses to mysticism and athletics for swimming and for their ability to work with magic. And they, as a racial trait, have a constant detect magic aura within 30 feet. They still have to concentrate to find sources of what the magic is as per the spell, but any time they're within something of 30 feet, they go, that's magic. I know it.
I don't think detect magic is a spell in Starfinder.
It is.
It is?
Yes. 0 level.
Oh, okay. I guess nobody ever uses it because you use just the class feature to identify stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we've used it. We just don't, like, lord it over anybody.
Have we? I don't remember Tom's Mystic ever casting detect magic.
I mean, we used it at Society 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, we did. That's right. Mm-hmm. I was there. Mm-hmm. I sat at that table.
I know.
I was explaining to the fans, not to you. I know you know. I trust your mental state most of the time. All right. So I hope you two don't mind, but I'm going to talk a little bit about designing races from like the designer's perspective since I have that insight. Is that cool with you?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. So when you're designing a race for Starfinder, the easiest way to think about it is that you basically get one really big ability and you get 3 smaller abilities, unless you're human. If you're human, you get 2 big abilities, because getting an extra skill rank is very big in Starfinder. So extra skill rank per level. If you take Lashunta, for example. Lashunta have 2 spell-like abilities, which are 2 minor ones. They also have the +2 to any 2 knowledge skills. Typically, getting a +2 bonus to 2 skills is worth 1 minor ability. And then they also have limited telepathy, which is minor. And then they have something else that's major that I'm not thinking of. The skill thing?
Yeah.
I don't think that's their big one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. Their big one is the spell-like abilities, because it has 2 spell-like abilities mushed together, and that's actually a little bit more powerful than the psychic magic feat. So that's their big one. And their other small one is that flexible ability choice, where they get to choose which their subtype. Mm-hmm. You sometimes see races mess with this formula. A great example is the Uplifted Bear, where the Uplifted Bear takes very subtle penalties in order to get extra abilities out of it. Like, if you look at their list, the list is huge, but they also get things like they're large, don't have reach, which is basically makes large a penalty rather than a bonus. And that generally holds true throughout all the... And so when I sit down to make a race, the first thing I do is I'm like, okay, well, I have this allocation of about 4 abilities that I can mix and match how I... So I knew I wanted to be able to make this etheric armor, And armor obviously should make you better at your armor class in some way. So I was like, all right, being in this suit of armor is going to give you a based
hold
on the
best. For the recording, you're cutting out severely right now. So reboot your call, please. We'll have Alex back in just a minute, gang.
Better?
Well, we'll know as you keep going.
Fair enough. All right, so backtracking a little bit. For my race, I was like, all right, if you're going to summon a big old chunky suit of armor, that should give you an armor class bonus. And so I was like, the typical number based on the Vesk is going to be +1. So I was like, all right, you're going to get a +1 racial bonus to armor when you're in this armor. And when I was designing the armor, I based it off of that cool cuttlefish race from the Aeon Throne adventure path, the one that makes a water bodysuit. I tried to change it enough in small ways so that, because like that ability, if you look at the cuttlefish race, that ability is worth like their major and 2 of their 3 minors. Like they only get like 1 other ability for it. And I think they take the base speed penalty where outside of the armor, they only have a base speed of 5 feet. basically when I sat down to look at it, I was like, all right, I'm going to give my race, since my race is a bunch of people who basically can't grow past being children, I'm going to give them a charisma bonus because they have these powerful, rowdy personalities, maybe even a little hyper like kids, and I'm going to give them a -4 penalty to strength because they're children. They're not physically strong. So that is an offset ability modifier. In Starfinder, every race has +2 total. If you take all of the ability bonuses and add them together, it always equals +2, with the exception of the cuttlefish race, because their armor also lets them nullify a -4 penalty. So that's kind of where this idea where being in the armor makes you stronger comes from. Then being in the armor also boosts your size up to medium, which actually doesn't really do a whole lot because they were small. That doesn't change their reach or any of their abilities. It's just a cool flavor bit. And it also gives them that +1 bonus to AC that I mentioned. But the way that I was thinking of it is that since they're encasing themselves in aether is going to be really hard to like sunder. It's probably going to be hard to knock them over because they're clad in this material that is designed to keep planes apart. So part of their ability is that racial bonus to armor class increases to +5 against combat maneuver attempts. So that's the normal +1 they already get, plus an additional +4 to offset something like improved maneuver. That's kind of where my number came from. So they are very tough to do combat maneuver too, which tends to be okay because the math on that makes them only like 10% better against monsters than they'd otherwise be, because monsters have such high attack bonuses. And really, it cancels out improved maneuver. So if you just throw improved maneuver on a monster, it's like, all right, I'm going to trip you now. It's very big, but it's not going to break the game, which is what I was going for. The other thing is that I wanted to make sure that I noted how the armor interacted with their equipment. Because in the case of the cuttlefish race makes a water body and then puts medium armor and uses medium items on that body. But I wanted this race to be, I wrap myself in aether. So the way that it works is that the race still uses small-sized armor, they use small-sized weapons, they use small-sized gear, and when they wrap themselves in aether, it's just putting piles of aether on top of their stuff. It's one of the reasons why they get that big bonus to combat maneuver attempts. It's harder to disarm them and to sunder them, because all of those items that they have are under just piles of ectoplasm and stuff. And it kind of adds for this like sort of different feel on what this armor is supposed to do. They have a base speed of 30 feet, which is pretty typical for small and medium races. I gave them 2 hit points because, as James mentioned, small races typically have 2 hit points, mediums typically have 4. And if you have a race that has a decent constitution or is generally bulky, you can bump that up by 2. Usually it means one of the minor abilities isn't quite as good as an other minor abilities would be. Sort of like how Vesk have like a super situational bonus against poison as one of their abilities. So I was like, all right, so we're going to give them 2 hit points. That'll be good. But I was like, I want them to be able to take a punch. So how am I going to do that? So I wrote this ability called Etheric Barrier, which basically gives them a free force field, a brown force field armor upgrade. They have an internal battery source for it, and that those battery charges are from flavor come from their actual soul. So their physical force of personality is what they project in front of them to reduce damage done to them. The number of charges that their internal battery gets goes up with their level. And if their charge total ever hits zero, their soul being drained causes them to take a -2 penalty to all rolls and checks, including damage rolls. So you don't want to drain out your soul battery. It's a bad idea.
Is there penalties really penalties, though, if they always have an ability that counteracts all the penalties you give them?
What do you mean?
Like, they're small, but they get medium. They have low hit points, but they get a force field. They have low strength, but they're... ability counteracts that, so it just seems like a big net nothing.
Right, so a lot of their racial traits are designed to sort of balance out some of the things they have in ways that are weird and cool. So, like, yeah, they're small, and they make this armor suit for themselves, which means that their big bonus, since they're canceling out that strength penalty, their big benefit is that they're getting a +1 to armor class. They have an extra +4 against all combat maneuvers. They have this etheric barrier temporary hit points things, but instead of the barrier canceling out the low hit points, it's more like the low hit points is an offset to the barrier. If they had the 4 hit points and the barrier, that might be a little bit much, but it's like, all right, well, if you're going to have all these extra temporary hit points anyway, let's lower this down a little. They do not have an ability that will get rid of the penalty for using all their charges, though. So if they spend all their charges, they're taking a flat -2 to everything, because their soul is out of juice. The battery's charges come back whenever they spend a resolve point to regain stamina points. So it will come back, and you can use it more often, just the same as how a force field armor upgrade is pretty easy to recharge just by putting a new battery into it. They also have an ability that lets them take a feat that improves the scaling on their armor upgrade, as a alternate class feature at 6th, 12th, or 18th levels. Basically, it works as if they were taking an archetype that's built into their racial trait. Finally, they can cast Psychokinetic Hand at will, which is Starfinder's version of Mage Hand, and they also can cast Unseen Servant once per day, using their level as the spellcaster level.
A lot of stuff there.
Yeah, well, it's actually just three abilities, but the one ability is chunky.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So mine's noticeably less chunky.
That's okay.
Size and type, they're medium sized, they're humanoids. Their building modifiers are +2 strength, +2 whiz, -2 dex, because they're more buffalo than gazelle. Hit point 6, because they're more buffalo than gazelle. And their abilities are gallop. They have 4 legs and a base speed of 50, which is about what 4-legged things have, as my research. They have a steady gait. They are able to move through difficult terrain created by plants, rocks, mud, and other natural causes without penalty. I stole that from a different race.
Woodland stride.
Whoa.
And the other ability they have is stubborn. The Abviro are naturally stubborn, receiving a +2 racial bonus to will saves against mind effects, and a +2 to the DC to influence them with bluff or diplomacy. And that's all they got. They might need more, but they might need less. I don't know how that works in the greater scheme of 3 and 3.
Well, let's see. The moving through difficult terrain is definitely a minor racial trait.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might not be, because
that's equivalent to the nimble moves feat. Or
it's actually better than nimble moves, because nimble moves limits you to 20 feet per movement.
Yeah,
so that's probably their major one. The very situational +1 bonus of saving throw against mind affecting effects. Even though mind affecting is a very common descriptor, that's still not all like will saves. Which all will saves a +1 would be a minor. So like that's a smaller one. And then you said they had a skill bonus too, right?
Nope. Oh, wait. Just a plus. The same thing that gives them the will save is a +2 to DC to influence them with bluff or diplomacy. That's mostly for NPCs, because PCs don't get influenced by bluff or diplomacy.
Well, if you add charisma-based skills, it could be a PC thing, because then it would be harder to intimidate them too. Unless you don't want them to be hard.
No, I want them to be scared crapless anytime. I almost wrote in a penalty to intimidates because then they're totally fear reacting.
If you give them bluff, then that would apply against fainting and the envoy's clever feint and clever attack ability. So like, it's not completely useless, but it's a good. It is definitely a good pairing for a very strong plus one bonus to against mind affecting effects. And who knows? Maybe somewhere down the line, Paizo will add something where diplomacy can be used aggressively, and then it'll be great. If one NPC has that one specific option. You go. you go, little dude.
I use diplomacy to shoot my starship cannon.
Oh, actually, you know, if they, isn't one of the starship things, like, you make a diplomacy check and compare it to the enemy's, like, CMD or something? Wouldn't that work on them? Or is that intimidate? I don't remember.
Probably intimidate.
I'm not good at captain roles. I'm always forced to be the pilot.
Yeah, there's, I believe it's intimidate.
Yeah. It might be intimidate then. Yeah. Cool. So I think that these sound really cool. They're fun and they're different, and they're also weird. Mm-hmm. These are aliens. These aren't normal things.
That's kind of what I was going for. Was just like something that like has familiar touchstones, but if you were to interact with it, like kind of think like the first person to ever see a duck-billed platypus. Yeah, you understand like the base parts, but together.
I just wanted a species that Picard and Data would argue about for an episode.
Like just a whole moral quandary zone.
It's like, how much do we interfere with the society?
I just wanted to do something weird that felt like this race lost something. Like they did, and that at the same time they kind of got something new to make up for it. I just think the idea of the whole concept for my race was like, you know, alien kids in Aether Mecha. And that's basically what I made. I really wanted to be able to say, I pilot my Aether suit. Even though you're not, it's just a thing that wraps you up. It's fine. They have overactive imaginations. Don't hate them for that.
It's like driving your own stink cloud. Except that it's very strong.
It's very strong. It's very powerful. Is the strongest. You won't break it. No wind will blow it away. There's no reprieve. All
right. So, now that we've had our species and their planets slightly detailed, what should be our topic for next time? What's our homework? What should our fans be discussing in the Create Demiplanet channel?
So I'm thinking that we have the basis of a bunch of different cultures and societies here. Mm-hmm. Like, we have yours, which is a very peace-enforcing autocracy. We have James, which is like this, almost like this burst of innovation where like nobody lives very long, and the fact that you're alive is a literal miracle. So like, make you the most of it. And then you have mine that is basically like warrior culture, but that nobody can live up to anymore. So
lost glory.
Well, yeah, because for mine, it's very tough. It's like, oh man, our people really valued being buff and, you know, super strong, and now we are all children. And we want to be able to die a glorious death so we can sit with our ancestors in the great afterlife, and we live forever as children. Great. So, like, we have a lot of interesting places where culture is, and especially established tradition, is challenged in interesting ways. This does bring up a good question, though. Gap, memory loss, how much did these races lose in that? What do you guys think?
I don't know that any of us addressed memory loss at all. We just had something terrible happen.
I think that it's important to have some context for things that happened during the time. I like the idea of complete memory loss being a Pack Worlds thing, and different places have different amounts of memory about stuff that happened. That is just my opinion. Also, the Pack Worlds has this thing where like a major cultural setting of their system disappeared. Like,
so I think this leads us to the topic, because we need to tackle two things, and they're closely related. It's the convergence is going to be related to what happened with the gap analog, and also the convergence and Hell World are closely related. So I think we need to do Hell World and how it relates to the Convergence and the Gap. We need the big bad for next topic.
Mm-hmm. We need to figure out what's making all of those isolationists start scrambling for help from the other peoples of the system, for sure. A lot of it, because like without that sort of that information, a lot of it just doesn't feel like it has. It's a very cohesive setting. It's like, here's that planet that nobody can go to because nobody from those deer, the little deer guys, won't talk to them.
Right. So it's like, so remember the thing that happened is whatever's on Hellworld really wrecks a planet when its cycle comes up. Uh-huh. But the Convergence is Hellworld opened everywhere. And it wrecked the whole thing. So we need to know what was Hellworld and how it wrecked crap.
And it poured out of the teleporters, right? That's what
we came
up with. Yeah. Right. It was the link that makes travel possible that was the ultimate downfall. Mm-hmm. So why don't we each come up with an answer to that question? And then we'll each talk about our answer for a little bit. We'll play off of each other. We'll discuss it. And then we'll give the polished answers that the three of us have all worked on. So, like, you know, James and I will offer feedback on Param's. Param and I will offer feedback on James. James and Param will offer feedback on mine. Mm-hmm. And then we'll come up with these three scenarios. And then after that episode, we'll let our Discord community vote on which one.
I hate votes because we don't get enough participation and things. Let's not make it a vote. A challenge that can have a very disappointing ending. Let's have us come up with our ideas and the community come up with their idea, and then we will just see what's cool about each idea and then merge them into the best idea. Because if yours is really cool, except James has this really neat thing, what I want is yours plus James. I don't want yours instead of James.
Okay.
And so one thing about the gap there is we talked before about the gates being made by a precursor race, but that precursor race wasn't actually extinct or anything. They're just still around, but not, like, prominent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the gap might be something where they lost the ability to remember how they made these things. So that's why they're not being upkept or made anyone's new or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
That's an idea.
And eventually they'll all break down and everyone in the system will be stranded.
Is the precursor race the race we're having be Hellworld's race?
We don't necessarily have to make it that way.
Hmm.
That one I think is up for is up for.
But we do say that Hellworld has to have a species, right?
Mm-hmm. Hellworld has to have a what?
A species.
Does it? Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it probably has something on it. But as far as, like, a token species for that planet, that might not be necessary. It might be a conglomerate of other things that have accumulated there.
It's all lumpy space princesses.
Oh, God, burn it.
All right, everyone. With that, we're out of time, so we've got our assignment. And our fans, please, me, James, and Alex are going to be putting our pitch together. Get to the Discord and start pitching ideas amongst yourself. See if you can beat us all out. There's way more of you than there are us.
I believe in you guys. Mm-hmm. Don't let what these two say change that. I believe in you.
Mm-hmm.
Show us the greatness of your brains.
Mm-hmm. And so we also want to thank our Patreon supporters. Without you, none of this is possible. The expansion of No Direction Network has been directly the cause of all your support. Giving us the funding to get servers and pay for equipment upgrades and just art, lots of art. If you haven't checked out the stellar art that has been posted around, we have the crew of our next AP being tossed around. You need to go see that in Vanessa's article that went up this morning detailing the backstories of each of the players. Totally go check that out.
That would be April 3rd, 2019 for those of you who are watching in the future.
Yep. And if you wish to join the Patreon supporters, you can do so at nodirectionpodcast.com. Click the Patreon link, and that's where you can join our Discord server, the chillest place to hang out and talk about Pathfinder, Starfinder, and all related tangency.
And remember, you definitely want to check out the Create Demiplane channel.
Mm-hmm. You can find more information at nodirectionpodcast.com, facebook.com/nodirection, youtube.com/nodirectionshow, twitter.com/nodirection, as well as nodirection@hotmail.com to send us emails. if you still prefer email as a communication format. Until next time, go beyond with no direction.